verily confirming that the very last item, the lighting Ming diode, is working. Back to you, Kate.
Oh, inside the remote.
Oh, what was that again, Eric?
It's a microprocessor, and as you know, there's a clock, it's a whole mess of stuff, it's very busy.
Okay, that was my point. I would say that the transients within the remote control would be enough to hear on the AM radio. That was the only point I was trying to bring up.
You're absolutely right,
WS2N.
Okay, S2N, you're absolutely right, Steve. So it's only the transients that the radio is picking up. And so many of the methods by which a remote control can die, particularly the push buttons, which are in many cases just a rubber click switch, whatever you want to call those things, those MEM switches, they are the highest point of failure. In some cases, the rubber switch really is a chunk of carbon on the inside, which comes down to a printed circuit board and it's supposed to make contact. Well, after you push those buttons real hard for a few years, you rub away all the carbon. There's nothing there to make contact. You're pressing harder and harder, particularly with dead batteries, and pretty soon you get no operation of certain buttons, and therefore there would be nothing for the AM radio. So the presence of the tones coming out of the AM radio is telling you that the buttons are working and that most of the electronics is working. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay.
This
is very helpful, because what happens is, like you're saying, maybe you think a button's working and it isn't. In my case, this is, you know, out of the box, brand new. And I had hooked it up, but what I didn't know, when I put all the connections in, I actually hooked it up incorrectly, because I used to have an RF modulator, the old DVD unit needed a RF modulator to go into this older TV. So when I got this, I'll put it right back into the RF modulator. So operating, everything worked fine, and I noticed every time I would record something, if I wanted to watch another show, you would hit this one button which toggles between the unit and the regular TV, and it wasn't toggling. I said, well, this is terrible. And that's how I got involved in reading the directions on this thing, and then they talked about checking the remote. So it's going to be a handy thing if you know about this, because right away I noticed it had a perfect signal when I pushed that button using the AM radio. So that told me this is working 100%. So I called up, there's a tech support. And they, after about 30 seconds of me telling them of how I had this thing hooked up, he said, no more. RF modulator is not needed for these units. Disconnect everything and wire it in the other way. And I did, and everything worked fine, and sure enough, that TV does now toggle between the unit and the television. So it's helpful. Like you said, you might think your batteries are low, you might think maybe one of your buttons isn't working, so it does have a very practical purpose. Back to you, Dick.
WJ2B for a quick comment.
Something BG, give me the full call and your name, and then go ahead with your comment.
Okay, hi Dick, everybody on net. This is Joe, WJ2B, Whiskey, Juliet, 2 Bravo. The quickest way that I usually check a infrared remote is you can put the LED of the remote in front of a digital camera, with the camera on record, and you should see the infrared light. The CCD sensors on most digital cameras will pick up the infrared light coming out of the remote. So you should be able to see it if the remote is working. Back over to you, Dick, WJ2B.
That was in the paperwork also, Dick, but I don't have one.
Very fine, Joe and Paul. Also, Radio Shack will sell you this little strip of material. I own one of these things. You charge it up by holding it under a light bulb. You take it into a dark room. It's an excited phosphor-like thing. You aim your remote control, and it's now measuring the infrared signal coming out of your remote control. And it flashes at you with the exact pulse pattern of your infrared remote television control or tape recorder control or whatever, CD player control. And most of them nowadays are IR sensitive, not RF sensitive anymore. So there's lots of ways you can detect the IR. And CCD cameras are very sensitive to it, even though they do put a filter in front of it to try to filter out the infrared response. That filter has a certain number of dB of cutoff, but it's not a complete cutoff. Therefore, when that bright light-emitting diode is blasting right into the front of the lens, that CCD camera is going to pick it up. You may have heard the story about the Sony cameras, which when you put them into the nighttime mode, it removed one of the filters. It picked up quite a bit of the infrared, and so people were setting the camera in that mode at high noon on a beach. The motive for doing that is that the infrared signal goes through nylon bathing suits like no tomorrow. And so people were using these Sony cameras for taking pictures of their favorite girlfriends in their nylon bathing suits with the infrared camera, and it essentially made the bathing suit pretty much transparent. So Sony got wind of that and put in better filters to stop people from doing that, because they were starting to be threatened with lawsuits for people who thought their privacy was being invaded by this kind of a camera. Well, as cameras are being developed, and I know about this industry because I'm mildly involved in it, cameras are being developed for doing surveillance for things like the controllers, the inspectors you've got at an airport. My mind's going blank, but you know the guys I'm talking about in the white suits. They're developing cameras for them, which will allow them to take either active or passive pictures of what you've got hidden under your clothing. And yes, we're getting into a privacy issue here, where when it comes to inspecting male passengers, it's going to have to be a male inspector, and female passengers, it's going to have to be a female inspector, because these cameras will look through clothing and see whatever you've got that you're hidden under your skin, whether it be a Boy Scout knife or whether it be a ceramic knife. It can see these kind of things because it looks different in the infrared emission by comparison to your skin. And so, therefore, these kind of inspections for surveillance are definitely required. So all kinds of cameras along these lines are being developed these days. Anybody with any comments about all these things? We're getting a little bit off of ham radio, but remember I promised that these are subjects of interest to ham radio operators, particularly male ham radio operators. KQRIW on the TechNet.
Jeff, you see KEY?
I heard KEY, and I think I heard Eric. Eric first.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you guys are interested in testing infrared remote controls, go over to MCM Electronics, and it's part number 72-005. It looks like a credit card. It's got a little spot on it. You point any infrared LED at it, and it will show up as an orange light.
How expensive is that thing, Eric?
I think it's about $3.
Fantastic. It sounds very similar to the credit cards shaped thing that is being sold by Radio Shack. I think I paid $4 for it at Radio Shack. Mel, go ahead.
Now, Roger, it's the same thing. I used to carry it in my pocket because a lot of the equipment that we had out, they had remote control to switch, you know, pictures on the closed circuit camera monitor systems on the multiplexes and all. So I was always checking, you know, the hand units, because they were always busting them up one way or the other. Let's see. Oh, I was going to make a comment. I took out of a TV set the receiver, the remote infrared receiver, little unit in there, a little square little unit that they have, you know, hanging on a printed circuit board. I took that and then I put it onto the scope, put it across the invertical input of the scope. And it's very interesting to see when you push the buttons on the hand unit, the different types of waveforms, the different versions of a square wave that are developed. You can see that strictly the different pulse widths of different buttons, Dick, over.
Very good. Sounds like a fun experiment. Now, here's something that Eric's going to really appreciate, but he's not going to recognize it right away. A good buddy of mine, WA5VJB, Kent Britton is his name. He lives in a little town outside of Dallas, Texas, called Grand Prairie. But he's got a friend that loaned him a piece of hardware. So with this piece of hardware, he goes on the 6-meter ham band. He's using a 100-watt transmitter on 6 meters. He's talking to a friend of his that he knows that he's talked to quite often, and the friend was something like 800 miles away. I think the friend was in the Chicago area, but I'm not sure. So the friend in Chicago, let's say it was Chicago, says, "Hey, Kent, boy, that signal you're putting out on 6 meters tonight is really potent. Wow. Do we have a band opening? How come you're the only guy I'm hearing? Eric says, well, I'm using my new antenna. My new antenna has got 10 dB of gain, or 11 dB of gain. And the friend in Chicago says, well, sounds to me like you got one of those long boom 6 or 7 element Yagis. Is it aimed at me? And he turns it back to Kent, and Kent says, no, this antenna is aimed all 360 degrees of space, but it's got 11 dB of gain. To which the friend says, oh, come on. You got some kind of a station master on 6 meters with 11 dB of gain? It would have to be 150 feet long. He sends it back to Eric, to Ken. Ken says, yeah, the antenna is 150 feet long. And the guy says, oh, come on. You're telling me a tall tale. Well, to be that strong without a band opening, you must have that thing at one hell of an altitude. How high is that antenna? And he didn't believe him. You know, he was just going along with the joke. He didn't believe the antenna is 150 feet high. And Kent says, well, my antenna is 1,800 feet. Come again? 1,800 feet above the ground, and this portion of ground is 300 feet above the surrounding terrain. So I'm at the 2,100 feet above the surrounding terrain with my 150-foot high antenna. To which his buddy in Chicago will say, says, oh, come on, Ken, you're telling me a tall story, a really tall story, a half-mile-high story. To which Ken says, no, it's real. They're setting up a brand-new broadcast station for Channel 2 television in the Dallas area on Cedar Hill, right outside of Dallas. This is a 1,800-foot-high tower. The tower and the antenna is working. The transmitter is not yet ready to go on the air for another 3 weeks. My buddy, who's the chief engineer, allowed me to connect my 6-meter transmitter with an adapter to the 4.5-inch diameter piece of hardline that goes up the 1,800-foot tower, bypass the filter, the bandpass filter for Channel 2 television. He's using the Channel 2 television transmitter in the Dallas, Texas area and transmitting on 6 meters. Ain't that a fun antenna? Unfortunately, he's going to lose access to them when that broadcast station goes on the air. But right now, the antenna and the tower is operational. The rest of the transmitter and the license is not there yet, and it's going to take another couple of weeks. Wouldn't that be a fun piece of hardware to use? While he was at it, Kent just happened to bring along his 432 transmitter, and he's putting 432 energy into a 6-meter antenna, into a Channel 2, 54 to 60 megacycle antenna. Yes, he did get a fairly high standing wave ratio, even after 1,800 feet of coax, 4.5-inch diameter airline, dry nitrogen filled. But with a little bit of an antenna tuner, he had no trouble matching it, and he talked to his friends on 432 at some ridiculous numbers of miles. And again, he gave them the same story. Am I using an antenna, 150 foot tall, on an 1,800 foot tower? Sounds like a fun operation. When I talked to Kent, he called me up at 7 o'clock in the morning. He said he'd been up for 24 hours. He used the system throughout the night because he knows he's losing the window of opportunity, and he wanted to get some real good use out of this thing. So he worked on the system all night long, talking to his friends on 6 and 432. Anybody any comments about all this? And Eric, when are you going to load this your antenna, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Very funny, Dick. Actually, we used to do that a lot on the World Trade Center, especially on Sunday nights when the stations would go down. We did a lot of DX on 220. Channel 13's antenna is, you know, just below 220, 213, 215. So you can hook the 220 rig up. Actually, we had a 220 repeater up there that was hooked up to the standby antennas, which was about 170 feet down the mast with a filter, you know, with a cavity. It worked out really fine. Although it's really hard to hear stuff up there, but when, you know, they shut everything down for maintenance, it's like a little gold mine. You know, you could bring a tuner or actually use some of the other people's antennas. We'd get together and hook hand rigs up to it, and it would be a fun night, so to speak, because some of the work that was going on, you had to turn the transmitters off for a while. So there were little windows of opportunities on somewhat of a regular basis. But, yeah, that can be a fun thing. Although you'll find that most broadcast antennas don't have a lot of gain, although I suspect that your friend there has got some delta batwing antennas up on it because it's so big. They usually run anywhere between 7 and 10 dB. K2RW, K2JS.
You're exactly right. This is a, I think it's a three- or a four-sided tower with a bunch of stacked bat wings on each of the faces of the tower, all fit as a great big circular phased array. And so the previous antenna down there on channel 2, somebody had changed one or two of the pieces of coax cable, Andrew Hardline, 7/8 inch I think it was, to one or two of the antennas. One of the cables got water in it, and somebody just said, well, it's got to be X number of feet long. He cut a piece of cable, threw it in there, and it was the wrong phase length and screwed up the pattern something fierce. And so therefore, for a whole lot of years in the Dallas area, the Channel 2 transmitter was giving them extremely poor coverage. I mean, people 5 miles out of town were not getting good television reception, and so that station was really struggling. And it got resold a couple of times because they couldn't fix the antenna. And I proposed to them a bunch of very simple tests by which they could measure the emitted phase of each of the bat wings on that antenna and find out which one is wrong in amplitude or phase. Instead of making the measurement on the tower, they hired a helicopter service to do a bunch of vertical probing. The helicopter went in a ring around the tower at 5 miles and made up and down measurements by the helicopter going from the ground up to 3,000 or 4,000 feet, back down, move over a little bit to another azimuth direction, and I hear tell the people on the helicopter got seasick as all hell, a terrible measurement, and what they did is to confirm that the pattern was really crazy. It was just out of this world, that something was awfully wrong. So they confirmed that it was bad. They already knew that ahead of time because all of their listeners out there, their television viewers were complaining about the fact they were getting a very snowy picture, a very small number of miles from this transmitter that was putting out a zillion watts of power. So the power is being squirted in lobes all over the place in space and wasn't going in the right spot because somebody had screwed up the order in which the pieces of phase length matched cable were attached to the bat wings. So that's an antenna. That's almost as good as what my buddies out at the San Bernardino Microwave Society do every so often. They borrow the 150-foot Stanford dish at Stanford, California, the big radio telescope of Stanford University, and aim it at the moon and do some very interesting moon bounce. They can hear moon bounce echoes that are twice around, bouncing to the moon, back to the Earth, back to the moon, and back again when they run high power. Or the guys that periodically borrow the 1,000-foot diameter radio telescope at Arecibo, Puerto Rico. The bad news there is that it can only be aimed 30 degrees from zenith, but when the moon sweeps through that particular window, that is a potent antenna. You can decide which one of the hills and valleys of the moon you're going to light up with your signal. And the moon with such antennas have been lit up on both 432 and 10 gigs and quite a few other frequencies. So some of these really big antennas on very high locations are an awful lot of fun to use. Anybody have any questions or comments about this before we proceed? Give me a call, that is right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Well, last thing, Dick, that's kind of standard procedure. There's actually three companies that do that, and I can show you the flyer around for New York if you're interested in seeing it. But how long ago was this?
That whole episode of them abandoning that tower, abandoning that antenna, and constructing a brand new one all took place in the last year for the Cedar Hill area of Dallas, Texas. What a waste. I mean, they essentially abandoned a beautiful 1,800-foot tower, a beautiful antenna installation, just because there were some errors in the phasing harness and the phasing lines that were at the 1,800-foot level. A smart guy with some very simple instrumentation could have easily confirmed that error. The problem is the subject of phase and phase accuracy measurements just confuses the living daylights out of an awful lot of engineers, and therefore nobody with any smarts in the right place at the right time made the measurements to confirm the error and therefore correct the error. Therefore, zillions of dollars worth of hardware were abandoned because of a couple of errors of a couple of pieces of 7/8 inch hardline. What a waste. I made multiple attempts to fix that one, and nobody would listen. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. I mean, you look at the actual hardware, what the splitter is, I mean, it's just a piece of pipe with four little things sticking out of it. But it just sounds like there's some, either they didn't hire a good consulting engineer, because there are a couple of really good guys. I mean, we've got one guy who has his own network analyzer he brings along, and every time we do something, we check it out. We know if it's even a fraction of an inch off. I mean, there's really no excuse for that kind of stuff. But it's a different part of the country. I guess they have a different way of looking at it. But, it's their money. It just seems silly to build a new tower with the new Channel 2 antenna that you're going to have to turn off in 3 years. K2RIW, K2RIW.
I'm with you. I'm with you. What a waste. Huh. Terrible. But I don't think they abandoned the tower, but they abandoned the antenna that was on the tower. I think they stripped it all away, or just abandoned it and just left it in the spot and putting other things on top of it. I'm not sure what all is going on there, but they didn't have the right people in the right place at the right time to make some very simple measurements. When that transmitter is running, the power out of it is so high that all you've got to do is stand inside the tower, reach through the screening. I mean, the bat wing antenna system at Channel 2 really consists of what you and I would call chicken wire, where the holes in the chicken wire or hardware cloth look to me like they're about 3 or 4 inches square. So with a very simple magnetic probe, just a loop of wire on the end of a piece of coax cable, standing inside the tower, sticking through that hardware cloth, you could easily pick up more than enough signal to make a passive measurement of phase, a very simple phase shift meter, so to speak, using the power of the transmitter itself, where you have one standard piece of cable always held back at the power divider. The other piece of cable, you walk it around the tower to each one of the bat wings and at each one of the levels and find out which one are the wrong phase or the wrong amplitude. Very simple passive measurement. I wouldn't even need 110 volts to power the test equipment because the RF energy would do that for you automatically. You and I could easily come up with very simple test equipment to do that procedure. I tried talking them into it. They had already been through so many horror stories of paying a fortune to that helicopter company. They did 2 or 3 tests like that, a whole bunch of ground measurements and whatever. They kept confirming that it was bad. They didn't get deep enough into analyzing the word bad. I mean, was it bad only to the north? Was the beam tilted 5 degrees above the horizon to the north and 4 degrees below the horizon to the south? I mean, simple questions like that were not analyzed, were not answered. All they knew is it wasn't working, it's terrible. That's not a
CBS station in Dallas, isn't it?
You got it, that's the one.
Okay, I know those people, and I also know the story now, and I know why.
Okay, if you're allowed to tell us, give us a couple of hints. If you're not, we'll understand. Up to you, Eric.
It has all to do with personalities, you know, and it's not nice to say things about people behind their back, but it's all about personalities. It's not about technical smarts.
Okay. I think you're saying that possibly some of the key personnel have an attitude, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with facts. Don't tell me.
That's kind of it, but you couldn't tell them that they were wrong about something.
Okay. I've often worked for that kind of a person where I had a project I worked on, let me think now, 11 years ago today. I'm working on a radar-like project, which was an IRAD, an independent research and development project, in which we wanted to make some radar-like measurements. And unfortunately, the person who was the project leader thought he was a radar expert, and he made certain pronouncements, and he decided that the whole premise of our IRAD was an incorrect one. Therefore, he cut off funding and cut off the project. We would protest, go to the powers that be, and get the project reinstated. And a month or two downrange, he would find some other thing he disagreed with, and he cut off the project again. We went through 3 cycles of that. Finally, I went to the chief scientist of the company, pleaded my case, and he said, can you give me any kind of a measurement to prove your point? And so in order to prove my point, I created the K2RIW radar. I literally took one of my pieces of 10 gig ham radio equipment, went to a building in Suffolk County that's a high building, aimed it at a particular radar system, and made the measurements with the RIW radar. Using my ham radio license, I wasn't transmitting pulses, I was receiving pulses. But I made the measurements to prove the concept, and therefore it was enough for the chief scientist to say, I'm taking over this project, we're going to bypass this program manager, and therefore we had a chance to go out to a military base, make a real measurement, confirm the concept. It worked like a charm. And so with my own hardware, on my own time, I borrowed some test equipment from the company on a weekend and went to a hotel, the 10th floor of a hotel, and made these measurements in order to get the project reinstated. I had enough emotional involvement and faith in the project that I wanted it to go forward. And so from our point of view, we were pushing the envelope, and we had some crazy person by my standards who was positive the concept wouldn't work, and he thought he was an expert. When we made the project work, the man who had cut off the project three times, including whispering in the ear of the vice president saying that if we had gone through with the project, we're going to be creating a lawsuit and whatever. When we made the project work, when he had told everyone it couldn't possibly work, it was beyond the laws of physics, he decided to quit the company. He left the company after 20 years of employment. Many people believe it was because of the embarrassment of that situation. The good news is that the project was successful. The bad news is that we lost a good man because of his closed-mindedness on a particular attitude. And it was one other disadvantage, and that is that the people I worked with after that, I couldn't easily bounce my crazy ideas off of them. Ordinarily, I would talk to these guys, and I would say, hey, do you think this will work? Or what are we going to do to make it work? And all of a sudden, people were afraid to challenge me. They were giving me credit for smarts that I didn't have. So it had a couple of crazy fallouts. And we got some awards out of that project, but that's another whole story. Okay, anyone else to discuss great big antennas? And we've also got this material. Let's see now. Before we get into that, I better... First of all, does anyone want to discuss the subject on hand before we go back to Mel? Give us a call. Let us right now. K2RIW, the TechNet. Okay. Mel, you wanted to discuss a couple of things. We're going to hear what you've got to say. Then we're going to go over to Paul to find out what's going on in space. Then with any time left over, there's one other subject that I could discuss. And if not, we can put it off until next week. KE2EJ, what are those RF savvy guys in Brooklyn doing this week, Mel? What are your merry group of guys in the Kings County Radio Club doing? Are they pushing the envelope again this week? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Okay, I think you, I don't know, did you want to toss it back to KE2EJ first to Eric before me? Over.
Okay, Eric, you got anything you want to add to all this?
No, not particularly. You've got it covered, so, you know, it's the, if you had the opportunity to watch NASA and see the space visitor, that was rather interesting, but that's kind of over now. But, and one last comment to you, have you done any more reading?
Yes, I have, and I haven't sucked it all up yet. Was it that lady Ansari, and is she the same lady that financed the Ansari Prize by which the Bert Rutan group flew into space twice? I think you're saying you saw Mrs. Ansari on the International Space Station. I presume she was taking photographs. I believe she was trying to get a ham license so she could use the equipment on board before she launched, although there are other ham radio operators on board that could be controlling the emission, so she should have been given permission to use the ham radio equipment. Give me a couple of words on that, Eric.
You know, actually, I'm not really all that aware because it was just like, you know, the NASA's up on the monitor, and every time I pick up my head and say, oh, there she is, look at what they're doing. So, you know, that was kind of my interest. I figured you'd know more.
I should, but I don't. I have to fix my satellite equipment. I had a couple of higher priorities this week. One of them is to get myself another automobile, and that's another whole story. And thank goodness for the Internet. And thank goodness for the Blue Book, the Kelly Blue Book information that's on the Internet. My current car, the car that I have been driving for the last 4 years, I finally had to abandon it. And I bought it from somebody who thought it was at end of life 4 years ago, and I got four more years out of it. and it served me very well. And then it required major repair. And the major repair, when it was declared to me by the garage, I said, hey, the car's only got 200,000 miles. Why should that go so soon? And the guy looked at me funny. He was afraid to laugh. He was afraid I was serious. And I finally said, hey, fella, that was a joke. Yes, a part is allowed to wear out after 200,000 miles. And so my current car I bought twice. I signed the contract for a particular price. I went to the Blue Book. I found out what that exact model, that exact VIN number, with those exact mileage and those exact accessories, what it was worth. And I presented that paperwork to the place that I was buying the car from and managed to negotiate another price at a significant difference. So thank goodness for the Internet and the information that's available to us. You use it properly. You use that Carfax, and you find out the whole history of that vehicle once you got a VIN number, and you use the Kelley Blue Book, and you find out that exact model number, that exact year with those accessories, what is it selling for in resale, what is it selling for in private sale, and what's the manufacturer's suggested sale price when you buy it from a dealer, the dealer price. All of that information is there. You buy a popular model, and boy, there's a lot of data. You can find out exactly what you should be paying. I fell in love with a particular color, a particular model number, and the fact that I paid a few extra dollars, I don't care. Doesn't matter. It's in the noise. I didn't want to pay a whole lot more, but a few extra dollars doesn't matter because I tend to keep cars for at least 5 or 7 years, and so the dollars per year starts becoming a small number, and the exact dollars I pay doesn't matter. Okay, Mel, enough of that jazz. What are the guys in Brooklyn, and what are the guys in Manhattan Beach? The guy in Manhattan Beach, what's he doing? K-E-2-K-E-Y in the TechNet.
We've got K-2-K-E-Y. Well, I'll tell you, that's right. I do the same thing with cars. I always say to myself, should I get this? Should I get the bad? I keep it so long, so if I do pay any additional amount of money for some particular contraption that I must have, you know, over the years, it adds up to very few dollars a year difference. Anyway, as I was alluding to with the loop effect, the old loops, this guy, Chuck, W number 8, TV, he has a nice call there, Washington 8 TV, he did this, all this experiment, and boy, he really did a lot of experimentation. He goes into a heck of a lot of detail, and he shows that the best, he was, like I say, making his measurements strictly by the load impedance using 50 ohm coaxial line, and the best he could find on the 80 meter band was one of his measurements was 40 plus J30 ohms, which translates to approximately two an SWR of 2. However, in all drawing all these Smith charts, he makes a reference here to John Krause. And John Krause is, I went and looked at John Krause's information that he had some very interesting idea of how to make this measurement. This is what I thought I'd run past you. This is, let's see, from John Krause's antenna manual, 1950 edition. John Krause, for instance, would take this if this was the measurement of 40 plus J30 ohms. For a 50 ohm cable, he would normalize it and then substitute it into a quadratic equation and make a chart right there so you don't have to do any plotting on a Smith chart. In other words, John Krause more or less says that he was explaining that this is a quick way by making load impedance measurements. You could then easily, with a handheld calculator or whatever, make your chart by taking this, normalizing it, normalizing your measurements, and then substitute it into a quadratic equation. I was wondering, did you ever use this method, Dick, over?
Oh, boy, do I use that method. For the last 3 years in a row, my main client for my consulting business, my electrical engineering consultant business, has me shoving dipole antennas in every possible nook and cranny left over in the devices that they're producing. So therefore, I end up with antennas that have got very high standing wave ratios. There are times when I'm trying to build an antenna that's got a 12.9-inch wavelength. That's what 915 megacycles is. And they want it to be squeezed in a space where they've got 3 inches left over, 2.5 inches left over. So I've got highly reactive antennas. By the way, 40 plus 30J antenna is exactly a 0.333 voltage reflection ratio, which is exactly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, just like you said. So I will, with a good Rodenschwartz network analyzer that sits on my desk, and I use it every single day, X number of hours per day, I make these measurements across the band, display it as a Smith chart or whatever. So I see what is the starting impedance of the antenna that's shoved in the corner alongside of a printed circuit board, alongside of other transmitters, other antennas and whatever. Terrible locations sometimes I've got to work with. And can you impedance match that by way of calculations? The answer is absolutely yes. And there's a zillion ways of doing it. Believe it or not, half the time I go through the calculations, and because I'm feeding the antenna with a ferrite device, a ballooning device made by Toco, and because the Toco has got insertion loss and a small amount of saturation characteristic, sometimes you're putting a watt through it, and the watt through the Toco is exactly what it's rated for if it's running into a low standing wave ratio. But the antenna is a high standing wave ratio. So either the voltage or the current is higher, and something is being saturated. So the Toco has got his own crazy characteristics that are nonlinear, and it doesn't fit the equations. So half the time, I use the Edisonian approach. I throw an inductor in here. Does it get better or worse? And then you make the inductor a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, or you use a tuning tool, you hold it near the coil of the inductor to increase or decrease the capacitance while you watch it on the network analyzer, and does it get better or worse? Half the time, I am a blind man walking up a hill. I can sense with my feet which way is uphill. And as long as there isn't some local little minor hill that gives me a confusion, most of the time I end up with a solution by the Edisonian approach. Half the time, if it's not a nonlinear characteristic going on, you can calculate ahead of time. If you know what is the exact impedance as a vector, in other words, you know the reactive component and you know the resistive component and you know their polarities, you can then say, okay, if I throw an inductor in here or if I throw in a capacitor there, you can recalculate what it's going to do. So half the time I do it by calculation, half the time I do it by Edisonian approach. In all cases, I can usually find a solution in about an hour, and that's good enough, because some of these projects, they need it within 5 days, and if I can do it within an hour, I'm a hero. And that's what I've been doing as an occupation, one of my main occupations for the last few years, Mel. I've been living in that exact environment. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I thought possibly that you had exposure to the situation, and let's see what kind of experience you've had with this particular method. And it's funny that, you know, this matching bit is batted back and forth, because it seems like no sooner that there is some really detailed study I never really thought that there was so much detailed study, let's put it this way, on the loop to begin with. I thought more or less for some years you never even heard of a loop antennas being used on 80 meters, because they all got the reputation of being a cloud warmer. If this antenna, oh yes, it'll work fine if you want to talk to your buddies here in Brooklyn or the Bronx or whatever, but that's it. But now it seems to be a whole different thinking, and finally he ends the article, in fact, which is quite lengthy. He ends it with the use of open wire feeders, like we have discussed. The problem, of course, like you said, with open wire feeders, there's very few commercial manufacturers for proper method of handling open wire feeders on a loop. as I guess I've detailed in the past, you know, experiences I've had, and finally, the only bliss I had with the situation was using, of course, the Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox that employs, as you say, big capacitors in there, big butterfly capacitors, plus it's link coupled. And rather than having a toroidal balun in, you know, into these couplers that they stick in there and use that as your balance feed input, which doesn't seem to work out too well with these loop systems. So the coupling systems, most of them have to be homebrewed. And again, you know, the ultimate way to go, which most likely a lot of hams for some reason, not into homebrewing anymore, even with antennas, which is most likely the best thing amateur radio operators can do, is experiment with antennas, is to, you know, build a coupler from the ground up using rotary and dual rotary inductors and all. So he, again, comes right back to this open wire feeders, and he says, it's funny, the last part of his last paragraph, he says, I recommend outpatient treatment for this cure, 1 hour of operating, at least at one hour operating per day for three or more days with the open wire feeders is the treatment best to provide sufficient therapy and warrant a discharge to the patient. So after going through all this, Dick, I think he's trying to convince everybody that to abandon the coax method of feeding a loop and go strictly to an open wire feeder, over.
When it comes to feeding a loop, which might at some frequencies give you a pretty high standing wave ratio, he might be right. It might be the simplest solution. Because to use coax in that environment and get full performance out of the coax requires at least two things. An extremely good baluning device at the end of the coax, and they're rare at frequencies like 80 meters. If you're doing it with ferrite toroids, you need a whole lot of them because you sometimes end up with some pretty fierce currents out there. Or some other kind of a baluning device like, say, for instance, a half-wave coax balun. Well, a half-wave coax balun is going to be something in the vicinity of 100 feet long. You're going to be winding that coax up in some convenient spot up there. It's a great big, pretty big coil. Although because 80 meters is such a low frequency, you may be able to use relatively small diameter coax. So the failures that people have had with coax are, number one, I don't think they had a clean enough balun, B-A-L-U-N, sometimes spelled B-A-L-U-U-N, but it really means balanced to unbalanced converting device, B-A-L-U-N. And Jerry Civic, W-2-F-M-I, has a whole series of books. I bought all of his books. He's got a whole series of discs, CD-ROM discs, explaining how these things work, pictures and whatever. I bought all of his material because Jerry has dug pretty deep into it. I've also found quite a few articles on the internet on baluning devices working at my particular frequencies. Unfortunately, there's very little ferrite that works well at 915 megs. At 80 meters, there's a lot of ferrite that'll and powdered iron, whatever, that'll work well. So starting off with a good balun is the first requirement. Starting off with a very wide range, high power antenna tuner matchbox is another requirement, with a large number of great big transmitting grade 365 picofarad air variable capacitors and roller inductors and whatever. We're describing a fairly massive device to do it right. And even when you go over to open wire line, the right kind of a transformer-like coupling, link coupling to the open wire line, and the right kind of a matchbox there is still your voluminous thing. If you think you're going to stack it into a rack panel 1.5 inches high, you're crazy. This is going to be as big as a DX100 transmitter used to be, at least. And for the guys that don't go back that far to the old tube transmitters, they probably don't know what I'm talking about. We're talking about a healthy 1 or 2 cubic feet of antenna tuner. And most of us think that we don't want to pay for something that big. We don't want to take up that much room on our desk. Well, in that case, you're not very serious about 160 and 80 meters and 40 meters and these kind of antennas. But if you're willing to make that investment in either elbow grease to build the thing, or dollars to buy it, or time to search down the surplus parts to build one. If you're not willing to do all that, then you're not going to get full performance on these bands. But when you do, it's worth it. There's ways you can make wire Yagis on 80 meters that you can easily put into your backyard. I'll admit you can't easily rotate them. There's ways you can make phased arrays. There's ways you can make loop antennas. And when you do finally make a good-sized loop antenna like you've got, Mel, you can experiment with various altitudes and various feeding techniques and various feeding positions. Do you feed it from the north? Do you feed it from the south? Do you feed it from the east? Do you feed it with common mode signals, with differential signals, or the right combination thereof? So there's a whole series of experiments that could be done. With the right computer modeling programs, you can predict some of this ahead of time. In your particular case, Mel, whenever you find the tuning arrangement that gives you the best performance for a particular direction or a particular time of day, if you have the right instrumentation where you can measure the reflected signal in magnitude and phase, it would take a vector voltmeter or it would take a network analyzer. But once you know the real input impedance with the real component and the phase component, in other words, what you gave me before, 40 ohms and plus J30, that kind of an exact answer at that exact kind of frequency, with a little bit of study, I can teach you how to design the ideal L network, T network, pi network, pi L network, or whatever, that'll give you a perfect impedance match losslessly. The transmitter will see 50 ohms, the antenna will see whatever it wants to see, and 99.9% of the power flows through and gets radiated into space. And whether you feed it with coax or open wire line is your choice. I just don't think that coax has been given a fair chance because of small range of antenna tuners and improper balancing. I think it has been given a bad rap. That's my opinion. But I haven't actually been there, and I've talked to a lot of guys who have, and they're trying very hard to convince me the other way around, that on these frequencies with those kind of antennas, the compendium of opinion is go open wire. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. K2RIW in the group, K2KEY. Well, that's what I was going to get to next. Now, there was another reference here to Walt Maxwell. W2DU did some work, I guess, similar ideas. And he was making suggestions. He actually, Walt Maxwell, does not say he actually did all the experiments in detail, such as this guy Chuck did, W8TV. He went ahead, Walt Maxwell, and he claiming, he says, well, in a case like this, he says, if we can come up, he says, with a system situation of similar, I don't know if he, I could say if he actually did it on the actual loop, but he says, it takes this
Mel, your mic is dropping out again.
Sorry, yeah, I let this button go here. It's got to really be pressed, and someday I guess I got to really tackle this thing. But all right, Walt Maxwell says if you take susceptance plot, he says you can then develop a shunt compensating stub and be able to correct the characteristic impedance, the ZC, deck over.
Absolutely. And that's the most lossless kind of impedance match. If you know the exact impedance, like the example you gave, 40 ohms resistive and plus 30 ohms reactive, if you plot that out on a piece of paper, the way people usually plot it is resistance is left and right, and reactance is up and down. Positive reactance up and negative reactance down. You've got these two orthogonal axes on a chart, and your particular impedance is a dot somewhere. In your case, it would be 40 ohms to the right and 30 ohms up. That's a dot. And that really is a particular spot on a Smith chart. And if you plot it at the different frequencies, the dot will move in certain ways. It always sweeps out a clockwise path of some kind from the origin. And so with that raw information, a smart person can say 1.5 feet downrange from this spot is where I put the T-connector. The T-connector goes over to a coaxial stub, which is either shorted or open, of a particular length. A smart person who understands Smith chart terminology can design the right location and the right length of a stub that brings all of that back to 50 ohms throughout most of that frequency range. That's an art and a science that, for the business you're in, Mel, is worth learning. I didn't say it's easy. It takes quite a bit of digging in. You're going to make a few errors a few times, but not to worry. It doesn't explode when you get it wrong. You just end up with a high standing wave ratio or a sharp antenna that's not broadband enough or whatever. There is something called the Bode-Fano criteria, where once you know the impedance characteristic across your frequency band of interest, you plug those numbers into the Bode-Fano, and it tells you with simple passive impedance matching what's the best you're going to get. Well, that's for broadband requirements, usually mil-spec and whatever. For us amateurs, which we usually have a fairly narrow band requirement in our favorite portion of the band, it isn't that difficult to do a single point impedance match, and don't worry about how broadband it is. But the right kind of a stub in the right location can solve a million sins. And so what's really going on here is that when you look at the Smith chart, you'll realize that as you sweep in frequency through your particular length of cable, you've got some kind of a circle-like pattern on the Smith chart. And the diameter of the circle tells you the magnitude of the standing wave ratio, and the frequencies and the length of the cable tell you how fast you sweep around that chart. And there's a couple of places in the chart at certain frequencies or certain positions on the transmission line where you pass through 50 ohms resistive. In almost all cases, there's reactance left over, but you pass through 50 ohms resistive. Then if you hang a stub at that exact location, if you happen to have 30 ohms of positive inductive reactance, and you hang a stub there that creates 30 ohms of negative, meaning capacitive, reactance to cancel your inductive reactance, there's nothing left over but the 50 ohms, and the rest of the cable downrange toward the transmitter is happy as a pig and you know what. So that's somewhat the philosophy of what's going on here, and it's worth learning, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, well, I was going to get to the next step. Yeah, I've got a chance to look into it more in depth, and I was really studying the Smith charts that he included with the articles quite in depth, and doing some calculations, both using John Krause's quadratic method and all. The only thing that starts to confuse me, and tell me maybe I've just got off the wrong path, I took the Y in the road there and the fork in the road, and take it, but I took the wrong one. But what was bothering me, and I just say, this may get a little hairy, but I found, for instance, that different values of the load impedance can actually, let me get it into the right words. If I took different values of the load impedance, I could yield the same SWR. So I was saying to myself, which one of the measurements is the true one? Because in such a case, what the heck did I do? I remember, let me get my paperwork here straight. For instance, I found that, duplication, that if I took 100 ohms plus J50, and I took, like, I think 50 ohms J50, I was able to get similar SWR readings. In other words, I could get two different load impedances. Let me see if I can put it in the right words. I could get used to find two different load impedances that yielded the same SWR, Dick, over.
I know where you're going from. I've been there, Mel, and I think I can help. Every real antenna, when you sweep in frequency, the resistive component goes up and down, the reactive component goes up and down, becomes negative and positive. That's reality. That's part of the complication. But let me simplify it one step at a time. Let me intentionally make a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, DC the light. I'm going to take a pair of 50-ohm non-inductive small resistors, maybe they're chip resistors. I'm going to put them in parallel. I'm going to make 25 ohms. If I'm hanging on that on the end of any piece of 50 ohm transmission line, I do have, by definition, exactly 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, DC to light, almost. So I've got a pure mismatch load that has the exact magnitude and the exact phase angle of mismatch at all possible frequencies at the load. I've created a pure 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now let's study that. Let me put that 2-to-1 standing wave ratio directly at the input connector of a well-calibrated network analyzer. I will see a single dot on the screen of the Smith chart of the network analyzer. It'll be left of center, halfway between the center, which is 50 ohms resistive, and the outer left-hand edge, which is 0 ohms. I'll be halfway between the two at the point called 25 ohms. And I'll scan the network analyzer from 3 megs to 30 megs, and that dot will sit in one spot. Now, let me take that exact same load, let me pick a number, 50 feet of coax cable, and connect it to that exact same network analyzer without changing the network analyzer. That exact same 2-to-1 perfect standing wave ratio load now is on a perfect piece of 50 ohm coax cable that happens to be 50 feet long, and when I sweep from 3 to 30 megs, I will now sweep a circle on the Smith chart. The circle will have a constant radius. The radius is the visoir. The radius is 2-to-1, and it's sweeping a circle on the Smith chart. And if I go far enough in frequency, the circle will completely close on itself. It starts off as that dot on the left-hand side, sweeps around clockwise as I go up in frequency. Every one of those possible spots on that circle is exactly 2-to-1. There's an infinite number of dots. There's an infinite number of ways I can make 2-to-1. If I stop at the left-hand most portion of the circle, it's 25 ohms resistive, 0 ohms reactive. If I stop at the most right-hand part of that circle, it is 100 ohms resistive and 0 ohms reactive. Whether I've got 100 ohms, and that's 2-to-1, or 25 ohms, that's 2-to-1, they're both exactly 2-to-1 with a particular phase angle of reflection. The 25 ohms is 0 angle of reflection, correction, 180, and the 100 ohms is zero degrees of phase angle, a reflected signal. All that has happened is the length of the coax cable is a delay line. The signal going through the 50 feet of cable gets delayed a certain amount in time. That's a fancy way of saying it created a phase shift. It hits the resistor. A certain amount of the signal is absorbed, but a big portion is reflected. One third of the voltage that you apply to the pair of resistors that make 25 ohms, one third of the application voltage gets reflected. The reflection coming back to the network analyzer is always one third of the voltage you put out. Therefore, that circle on that Smith chart has a magnitude of one third of a volt, if I'm putting out 1 volt. That's a constant circle of one third radius, and now all the dots on that circle are all the ways that I can make a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. There's an infinite number of ways, but every one of them is unique, Mel. Every one of them has an exact number of ohms of resistance and an exact number of ohms of reactance that you can read off of that Smith chart. There's one other trick that a good modern-day network analyzer can do. It's got a built-in, let's call it calibrator, normalizer, whatever you want, where you can tell it, I don't want it to be calibrated and normalized for the front panel. I want it to be normalized at the end of my 50-ohm cable. So I connect my 50 feet of 50-ohm cable to the network analyzer. At the far end connector where I'm about to put your resistors, I connect my calibration kit. The calibration kit consists of a perfect short circuit, a perfect open circuit, and a 50-ohm load. You go through the calibration procedure. The network analyzer goes into a great big 12-point correcting algorithm, and it normalizes itself for the end of the 50-ohm cable. It thinks that's the connector on the front panel. Now when I connect my 25-ohm resistor, my pair of 50-ohm